From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Marianne Faithfull has had a long career with some big setbacks. She had a hit in the early 60s with the song As Tears Go By, which was written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. Faithfull's liaison with Mick Jagger kept her in the public eye. In the 70s, she lost herself in drugs but made a comeback by the end of that decade. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Faithfull about her new CD, Before the Poison, which features songs written by PJ Harvey and Nick Cave. We'll also hear an excerpt of an interview we recorded in 1994. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Couple Next Door, a collection of comic mystery stories by Margaret Miller. It's part of the Lost Classics series, which aims to bring out-of-print books back from obscurity. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Marianne Faithfull has a new CD called Before the Poison. We're going to listen to an interview I recorded with her a few days ago. Later, we'll hear an excerpt of our 1994 conversation. Faithfull's first record was the 1964 hit As Tears Go By, which was written by Rolling Stones' Mick Jagger and Keith Richards.
It is the evening of the day. I sit and watch the children play. Smiling faces I can see, but not for me. Sit and watch as tears go by. My riches come by.
Marianne Faithfull was 17 when that record was released. At 18, she was married and became a mother. When she was 19, she began an affair with Mick Jagger and lived in the middle of a scene of parties and celebrities that zillions of teenagers yearned to be part of. But by 1970, she and Jagger had split up, and she had become addicted to heroin. At her low point, she lived on the street. She started recording again in the late 70s, and her voice was no longer the pure, innocent, uninflected voice of As Tears Go By. In the past couple of decades, she's been singing many original songs, as well as songs by Kurt Vile. Her new CD, Before the Poison, features several songs she co-wrote with P.J. Harvey and Nick Cave. This song, The Mystery of Love, has words and music by P.J. Harvey.
When you're not by my side, the world's in two, and I'm a fool. When you're not in my side, just fades from view. The mystery of love belongs to you. The mystery of love belongs to you.
That's Marianne Faithfull from her new CD, Before the Poison. Marianne Faithfull, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Now, this song was by P.J. Harvey, who collaborates on several of the songs.
It's written by Polly, specially for me, actually.
What are some of the things you think you have in common with her?
Well, I didn't know. You know, the first thing we had to do was meet her. I'm a huge fan of her work. I really like what she does, and I like her attitude. So there's that. But of course, we had to meet to see if we liked each other. And we did meet in Los Angeles while I was still recording Kissing Time, and we did like each other. And what we decided we wanted to do was make a very, very dark record.
You succeeded.
Darker than any Marianne Faithfull record that has ever been before.
That's some stiff competition.
Well, I don't know if we managed it, but it's pretty dark.
Now, your voice is very dark. Your voice is very different from the way it was at the start of your career.
Well, obviously.
Yes. Well, some people's voices change more than others.
Mine was always, you know, I studied singing at school when I was young. And my singing teacher used to say to me in hushed tones, you know, you have a soprano now, but I think if you're very, very lucky, it will become a contralto.
Why did your teacher think that would be good luck if it did?
Well, it's a very rare thing to have. It's Kathleen Ferrier. You know, there are very few real contraltos. And I'm one of them.
I don't know what you'll make of this, but I think of you as being similar to Billie Holiday and Lottie Lenya, as having as great singers whose voices were very different at the beginning and end of their careers.
Of course. But that's partly technical, like I told you, but it's also experience. It's, in my case, I mean, thank you very much for comparing me in any way with my great heroines, Billie Holiday and Lotte Lenya. But in my case, and I'm sure in their case, you know, a lot of it is down to experience. You get the voice you really want. You get what I suppose a writer would call it, finding my voice.
Was there anything that you missed about that pure soprano that you had? You know, the high notes or that...
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, if I hadn't been discovered by Andrew Oldham and gone into the pop business, I would have probably either become an actress or I might have gone to the Royal Academy of Music in London and I could have sung Mozart. I would have enjoyed that. But on the other hand, you know, I kind of... it was very exciting to be in at the beginning of a new thing, which is what was happening in London in the early 60s. And I was right there.
You know, it's interesting, like As Tears Go By, which is your famous first hit, you're singing in an almost uninflected voice.
That's what Andrew wanted.
That's what he wanted. Why? This is Andrew Luke Oldham, who was your producer, and he was the Rolling Stones producer.
He was my manager.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. And I suppose he was the producer, too. Yeah.
So why did he want it uninflected?
I don't know. I think he wanted me to sound like Mick.
Huh.
I really don't know. You'd have to ask Andrew.
It's so interesting because there's so much drama in your singing now.
Well, yeah, but that's my natural thing. Maybe I didn't have that yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you mentioned that...
I was only 17.
Right, right.
I don't think I had any.
Any drama?
No, and I was terribly, terribly nervous. So probably the natural thing I did was just sort of do what I do when I'm very frightened, is pretend I'm very small and stay very still and do as little as possible.
Now, you mentioned that Lotte Lenya is one of your music heroes.
Mm.
So I thought maybe we could listen to a recording in which you sing Kurt Weill.
Mm.
And you made a recording. You've done a lot of Kurt Weill.
I've done two records of the Brecht Weill canon. The first one was the Cabaret record, which was 20th Century Blues, which I love. But my actual total favorite of all time is The Seven Deadly Sins. But play something from 20th Century Blues. Play Pirate Jenny. I like Pirate Jenny because it's so fierce.
And Paul Trueblood is at the piano, and he sounds
Paul
great
Trueblood
with you.
Is such a great musician. Mm-hmm. And I was so lucky to work with him. And I'm very fond of him.
Well, let's go for the drama and hear Pirate Jenny. And this is from Marianne Faithfull's album 20th Century Blues with Paul Trueblood at the piano.
You lads see me wash the glasses, wipe the floors, make the beds. I'm the best of servants. You can kindly throw me pennies and I thank you very much. And you see me ragged and tattered in this dirty hotel. You don't know in hell who's talking. You still don't know in hell who's talking. Yet one fine day there will be roars from the harbour, and you'll ask what is all that screeching for. And you'll see me smiling as I dunk the glasses, and you'll say, what's she got to smile at for? And the ship, eight sails shining, 55 cannons wide, sir, waits there at the quay. You say, work on, wipe the glasses, my girl, and just slip me a dirty...
Marianne Faithfull, how were you introduced to the music of Kurt Weill?
Well, I sort of grew up with it, you know. Both my parents, I don't know how they did it. I don't know how my mother did this. But she brought 78s with her from Vienna. And a lot of the songs on 20th Century Blues are my mother's favourite songs or my father's favourite songs. Like, my father's favourite song was Falling in Love Again.
Huh.
And he loved Cole Porter and he loved all sorts of things like that.
So is that like the first music you heard?
I suppose it is, yes. Yeah.
Was your mother a singer? I had read that she...
No.
No?
My mother was a dancer.
Oh.
She was very young, of course. And she was only 24 when Mr. Hitler marched into Vienna in the Anschluss. But she was a dancer in Berlin. And she, as she would be coming into the theatre to rehearse as the corps de ballet for Mr. Reinhardt, would see Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht staggering out in the morning, having been up all night writing the Threepney Opera. And they would all bob a little curtsy and say, Guten Morgen, Mr. Weill. Guten Morgen, Mr. Brecht.
When you were growing up, did she have, like, clothes from... from her costumes from when she danced in the closet?
Not much, no. I just have a very beautiful piece of chiffon and some beads. I have very little. She didn't bring any of that much with her. No, I don't know what happened to it.
But that sense of theatre was...
It's as if she wanted to leave it all behind and have a new life. She'd had quite a hard time, I think, during the war. My grandmother was Jewish, you know. And she met my father was a spy. I mean, it's so incredible, it's amazing. And she was his contact in Vienna. So it was really, I think she was really happy to marry my father and get out. Unfortunately, of course, the marriage was a disaster. But
well, I think they separated when you were six or something, right?
Yes.
And then you lived with your mother.
I did, yes.
You know, while we're talking about theater, you were just starring in a musical.
Well, I wouldn't call it a musical. Call it a theatre play with music.
Okay.
You mean The Black Rider?
Yes.
Yes, well, that was a wonderful experience. Very, very hard work, of course, because I did not go to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, but just became a pop singer. I'm not really trained up to do that sort of every night matinees, one day off a week. It was incredibly hard work for me. But, of course, what could I do? Bob Wilson offered me the part of the devil.
So
I
this
couldn't
was,
say
this was,
no to that, could I?
So this is like a text by William Burroughs, music by Tom Waits.
Text by Bill Burroughs, my old friend. Music by Tom Waits, also my old friend. And my new friend, Bob Wilson.
This is the theatre director, Robert Wilson. Now, this play was written by William Burroughs. What was it like for you? You eventually became a friend of his, but I imagine that you read him before you knew him.
I did, yes.
How old
were
you?
Well, no, actually, no. I met him in London in the 60s.
Oh.
But he certainly wasn't interested in a little girl like me. But I did become great friends with him much later.
Mm. What reaction did you have to his writing? What impact did it have
on
you?
Well, I thought that was exactly what I had to do. So I took it very, very literally.
What was it that he did that you felt you had? Which aspect of the life that he described?
Oh, please don't make me say it.
You're talking about the drugs or just a bohemian lifestyle?
I'm talking about going out and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Don't make me say it.
Right, right. Mm. Did he make it seem romantic?
No, he just made it seem absolutely the only way to live.
Mm-hmm.
What a great thing to do, I thought to myself. I guess by then, fame and fortune and all that stuff was beginning to grate a lot.
My guest is Marianne Faithfull. Her new CD is called Before the Poison. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Marianne Faithfull. She has a new CD called Before the Poison. Now, I want to mention another song that seems a little out of character for you on your previous CD, which was...
Well, my previous CD, which I do love, mm-hmm. you mean Kissing Time?
Yes.
Was, in fact, a very experimental work. I wanted to learn about the new technology. That's what I did it. And so I went to the best people, like Billy Corgan, like Beck, like Jarvis Cocker, like Damon.
Well, a song here that strikes me as a really interesting choice, a kind of out of character, is I'm Into Something Good, which was...
Oh, that was just fun.
Yeah, well, that was a Herman's Hermits hit in 1964.
I love doing that. Yeah, and you've got to remember, when we did Kissing Time, the mm-hmm. world was a different place. And we could have fun, and we did, and we loved it.
We know
Billy
and
I.
The year that was a hit... Into Something Good, 1964 was, I think, the year.
It was the year As Tears Go By.
The year, and I think it was about that time that you started on tour, and you went on a tour, not with Herman's Hermits, but with Freddie and the Dreamers and the Hollies.
They were good.
Jerry and the Pacemakers.
Yep.
Where did you see yourself fitting in? As
I didn't fit in. I was completely out of place, and I actually believed that I would go back to school when the tour was over and pick up my life again.
Were you like the only girl in the tour?
And what I was doing was reading my A-level books.
Oh, because you were still in school.
Well, that's what I thought I was, yes. So, but I do remember very well how kind the Hollies were to me. Really sweet.
Did the guys on the tour try to be protective or try to take advantage of you?
No, of course they didn't. I mean, I kind of, you know, I did learn the meaning of the word tour romance.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was rather fun. Why not?
Well, I'm going to play I'm Into Something Good from your previous album, Kissing Time.
Good.
Okay.
I think it's charming.
Me too.
And, you know, now in this world, I could never do something like that again. That's why it's called Before the Poison.
That's why the new CD is called that.
Yeah. But let's remember the days when we could do something like this.
Okay, so this is Marianne Faithfull from her previous CD, Kissing Time.
Woke up this morning feeling fine. There's something special on my mind. Last night I met a new guy in the neighborhood. Oh yeah. Something tells me I'm into something good. He's the kind of guy who's not too shy.
Marianne Faithfull from her previous CD, Kissin' Time, the 1964 hit, I'm Into Something Good. And she has a new CD called Before the Poison.
Much darker.
At what point did you start getting to know the, and I assume that you did at some point, the Andy Warhol factory crew?
I didn't.
You never knew them?
No, I never did.
It just seems to me you'd have connected at some point.
Never. Never, 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 never. I went to New York once with Andrew. And what I did do was meet up with Al Grossman and Bobby Newhouse. And it was the time when Bob Dylan had his motorbike accident. And I think I had my first joint with Bobby Newhouse. And I was up all night being sick.
From the joint?
Mm-hmm. I was 18.
Right.
Wasn't able, didn't know anything. Just couldn't deal with it.
Hmm. So, you know, I'm wondering what you thought, because you must have been aware of this, whether you knew the Velvet Underground personally or not.
Oh, I thought they were wonderful.
Yeah.
But I had a sense of self-preservation, which told me, do not go to New York. You will die.
Right, because you'd get so deep into it with...
I would be... It would have been another Edie Sedgwick, you know. It was quite bad enough in London, if I may say so. But, I mean, it would have been too much for me. At least I knew London.
What did you make of it when the Velvet Underground recorded Venus and Furs?
And I didn't really think about it.
I ask this in case our listeners are confused. My
great great uncle,
yes,
was Baron Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, who gave his name to masochism and wrote a book called Venus in Furs. Yeah, I mean, I sort of noticed it, but didn't really notice it. There were other songs on the Velvet Underground that I thought were better. I didn't think that was one of the best. I'm a huge, and was always a huge fan of Andy Warhol. I mean, before I got discovered and all that stuff happened, my mother took me to see a huge Andy Warhol retrospective at the Tate. I went to see the Picasso retrospective. I went to see the Surrealist retrospective. It was wonderful, you know. I had a wonderful life before all that stuff happened.
Marianne Faithfull will be back in the second half of the show. Her new CD is called Before the Poison. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Before the poison, I wasn't down. If you'd been there, if you'd been around, I couldn't hear, couldn't hear a sound.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Animal Crackers, Anna Tinti's debut story collection that explores human fears and longings. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we listen back to a 1994 interview with Marianne Faithfull, and we conclude our recent conversation. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a lost classic, now back in print.
He walks along, singing his fairy song, picking up magic that grows at his feet. She says her say in her peculiar way, dreaming good fortune on everyone's street. Say hey, have you heard the whiskey's the rage? I'll send you a jug in the morning. It is absurd to live in a cage. You know there's got to be something better. As they go by, don't look with eagle's eyes. Smile on your jailers until they grow weak. Nothing can compare to something that's almost there. The cherry plum madness that all of us see. Say hey, have you heard? Blue whiskey is the rage. I send you a jug.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Marianne Faithfull. She has a new CD called Before the Poison. Before we get back to the interview I recorded with her a few days ago, we're going to hear an excerpt of the conversation we had in 1994, after the publication of her autobiography. It told about her music career and the heroin addiction that nearly killed her. She wrote that when she was in rehab in 1985, as part of the therapy process, each person was expected to tell his or her story. That's when she realized there was a blank in her life. She had a sense of being part of the Rolling Stones scene when she and Mick Jagger were lovers in the 60s, but she had no idea what her own story was.
I think that's one of the saddest things in the book, that bit where I'm in Hazelden and they asked me to tell my story, and I actually rang Ellen Smith, my publicist, and said to her, please send me up and down with the Rolling Stones because they want my story.
Which was a book about the Stones.
Yes. That's what I, that is sort of very telling, you know.
What led to that feeling that you didn't know what your
Well, I didn't know
was?
When I said that, that I didn't have a story. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still thought that my story was the same story as the Rolling Stones. I didn't figure this out for another year. I'm very slow.
So tell us the story of how you met Mick Jagger.
Well, I went along to a party with my first boyfriend, John Dunbar, who was a friend of Peter and Gordon. And Paul McCartney was going out with Jane Asher. It's so hard to remember all these things. And somehow, John was always up for a party. And especially then, when we were very young. I mean, I was 17. He must have been 19, you know, 19, 20, no more. But, you know, it was just a party. But it was a dead glam party, I suppose, even for London. And it was a lot of fun, I suppose, yes. I mean, it's somewhat sort of coloured in my imagination now by the fact that I was discovered there. But
what do you mean you were discovered there?
I was just, well, that's where Andrew Oldham saw me. I was discovered by several people at that party, actually. Andrew Oldham is the only person I gave my address to.
And he was the producer of your first records,
yes,
and of the Rolling,
yes,
Stones.
He managed the Rolling Stones, made their early records.
Now, what did he discover in you? Was it your look, or did he know that you sang?
No, he didn't know I sang. Now, that was just a sort of bit of luck, I think.
In your memoir, you reprint a press release that was written for when As Tears Go By was released. And it says, Marianne Faithfull is the little 17-year-old blonde who still attends a convent in Reading, daughter of the Baroness Orisso. She is lissome and lovely with long blonde hair.
Lots of alliteration in this press release,
yeah,
isn't there?
Yes. A shy smile and a liking for people who are long-haired and socially conscious. Marianne digs Marlon Brando, Woodbine cigarettes, poetry, going to the ballet, and wearing long evening dresses. She is shy, wistful, waif-like. Now, what did you think of that image of yourself?
I thought it was a hoot. I remember taking it back to my mum. And sitting in Milman Road reading it to my mother and Chris, my brother, we just fell about laughing, you know. I never in my wildest dreams thought that people would think I was like that. Although I did dig Marlon Brando. That's true. And I was at a convent. And my mother was a baroness. But apart from that, but then again, you know, I can't be too sort of sticky about this because it's quite obvious that we none of us really see ourselves as others see us.
Now you ended up doing a lot of drugs, doing a lot of heroin. How did you start doing heroin?
I used it as a coping mechanism, I think.
For coping with what?
For coping with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked for a while, but it did have a tremendous drawback, which was that it was addictive and it would kill you.
How long did it take you to figure that out?
Ages. Very long time. But I did figure it out eventually, thank God.
Now, I want to play a song that you wrote the lyrics for called Sister Morphine.
Mm.
That was released in England in 1969. Tell me a little bit about where you were in your life when you wrote the song and what the lyrics are about.
I don't know. It's a very weird thing about Sister Morphine because, you know, it was knocking about the house for 6 months. And Mick was playing it all the time.
Playing the melody.
Playing the basic thing. Da, 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 that thing all the time. So it went into my sort of whole sort of nervous system, blood, bones, whatever, everything. I really had it in my I knew it by heart, let's say that anyway. And then I remember it, and I'm sure Mick does too. It was very peculiar. I just sat down, picked up a legal pad and a pencil and wrote it out, you know. And there it was. But I do that sometimes. It's obvious. I work on it in my head. And then when it's all ready, I do it.
Why don't we hear Sister Morphine? This is Marianne Faithfull, recorded in 1969.
Scream,
Marian Faithfull is my guest, and she's written an autobiography called Faithfull. The record company, Decca, you say yanked this record about 2 days after it was released.
They took it off the shelves.
What was their objection?
Well, there were many. The lyrics were very ahead of their time. It's one thing for Lou Reed to sing heroin, obviously. It was completely... This is something I really didn't understand, that this thing about me being this beautiful little angel was real. I never really believed that. I couldn't believe it. So I suppose for Decca, you know, the last thing they put out by Marianne Faithfull, I can't remember what it was Summer Nights, say. I think it was. That was in 1965. And then in 1969, they're given Sister Morphine. And they couldn't handle it.
You said that after you became a junkie that it actually brought you anonymity that you hadn't known since you were 16, since 17, that is. You were living on the street. I'm sure that wasn't exactly, though, the kind of anonymity that you wanted.
Well, I hadn't wanted celebrity in the first place. I just went to a party and got discovered. And I hadn't had time to think about whether I wanted it or not. So the anonymity I got in the street was very valuable to me.
Where were you living? How did you live during those years?
Well, I lived on a wall. I lived on a wall in Soho. And it was an amazing time for me. When I really couldn't take it, I could always go back to my mother's. You know, it wasn't like I had nothing. I wasn't exactly the same as the street people. But they didn't mind that.
Marianne Faithfull, recorded in 1994. We'll hear more of our recent interview and more music from her new CD after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded a few days ago with singer and songwriter Marianne Faithfull. She intended her new CD, Before the Poison, to be her darkest record, and she collaborated with two dark songwriters, Nick Cave and PJ Harvey. Did you feel, I mean, you've lived in a very unconventional world your whole adult life.
Well, my whole life as a child.
That's what I was wondering.
My parents were extremely unconventional. And I was brought up in a delightful bohemian manner. So I sailed right into swinging London with no problem.
Tell us a little bit about the delightful bohemian manner that you were brought up in.
Well, my father was a real idealist. After the war, he formed a commune, not like a 60s commune, a 50s or even a 40s commune, more like an Iris Murdoch kind of thing. And the purpose of this place, which was called Braziers Park, was to change the world and to teach people, only Europeans, he couldn't really go further than that, to live together in harmony so that war would never happen again. And that was my father's mission. My mother was also an idealist in a way, but not quite as serious as my father. And she didn't really like it at Braziers Park. She didn't like living in a commune. And it split up, and she thought she was marrying an English gentleman, you know? And she thought she would have a much more conventional life. She didn't realise she was marrying this wonderful world-class loon.
Did you live on the commune at all?
I used to go at weekends. I had a wonderful time.
What was it like as a girl?
There was a farm. I watched calves being born. I had a friend who had a pony. I didn't have anything to do with the commune. I was just out from dawn till dusk.
And did your father talk to you about the philosophy behind it?
No, not till I got much older. And then I found it very interesting. You know, he used to give courses on Alexander Pope and things like that. Before I wrote my book, he did a course specially, really, for me, on the writing of autobiography.
You're kidding.
No.
How did it affect the writing of your 1994 autobiography?
Well, he really helped. He was a really great teacher, you know. He was a professor at Bedford College in London. He taught me a lot. I learned in his course about autobiography that it was absolutely essential to put dialogue in, or it got very boring.
Well, that's always interesting to me, because I read so many autobiographies and I always think, who has the memory to really remember what somebody said and what you said back?
Well, you can't really, but you can make a rough guess.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote it from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I don't put thoughts and feelings into other people. I wrote about me and what I felt and what I did. And I remember everything. And I remember how I felt. I remember my motives. I remember what I did and what I thought of things I saw around me. And in fact, I was very, very hard on myself. I realize that now. But I didn't see any other way. Any other honorable way to be.
How far away does the really hard time seem to you when you were homeless?
Seems like a long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Really. And I know I was very lucky to get through it. It was obviously something I needed to learn. And in a strange way, I learned some very positive things, you know.
Have you asked yourself why you think you survived?
No.
Why so many other people don't?
I guess no junkie dies in vain. Everybody who dies, for each one who dies, another survives. I don't really know why I survived. I tried incredibly hard not to, but finally I did accept that I had to survive. And there must be some reason why I had to survive, and I might as well accept it. And when I did that, everything got a lot easier, of course.
You occupy a kind of unique spot in pop music now because, you know, you were a teenage pop star, but what you're doing now is somewhere
a pop
between...
pop princess.
Yeah. What you're doing now is a kind of... What you're doing now is a kind of hybrid of cabaret and theater music and pop and rock. And
I don't really do cabaret. I do rock and roll. Sort of. With a lot of drama. I don't know what I do. I do what I do, you know.
And if you don't mind my mentioning your age... Is that?
I don't mind. I've just turned 58.
Right. And, you know, back when you were starting in the 60s, there still was the sense of what do rock and rollers do when they get older?
Well, I didn't think I would.
You didn't think you'd live that long?
No way. I thought a broken English was the end. I thought after that I would die. You could have knocked me down with a feather when I had to make another record.
And broken English was, 1979?
Yep.
Right.
I thought that was it. I thought, go out in a blaze of glory. Off you go.
Before the interview started, you mentioned to me that you stopped smoking about three weeks ago.
Yeah.
And why did you decide to stop after all these years?
Well, I've been wanting to stop for about a year because I've got the beginning of emphysema. And my mother died of emphysema and alcoholism. So I kind of didn't really want history to repeat itself. So I did everything I could. I went to a hypnotist. I read Alan Carr. I did all these things. Nothing worked. Then just before I came to America, I got really bad bronchitis, really bad. And I could not even think of smoking. So I didn't. I stopped. And I'm using a patch, of course. I'm beginning to not need the patch now. It's sort of getting easier. I've done this whole interview without a patch. They make me sick. They actually are rather like bad speed, patches. But, you know, time went by. The bronchitis got better. I've had some terrible moments of craving. But my doctor in Paris it's very like giving up drugs, you know. They don't last long, the cravings. They last about 5 minutes. So you just find something else to do. You talk to somebody, you put your makeup on, you do anything. You wash your knickers, anything you can think of. And the craving will pass, and then it's gone.
What is the action that you typically take that seems most incomplete without a cigarette?
Well, the one I'm really worried about is face-to-face promo. Because in that, I wasn't using nicotine just as a drug. I was using it as a prop and as a smokescreen.
Oh.
That's going to be pretty scary. I've got to think of something else to do with my hands, and I've got to give myself a smokescreen. Joysticks? I don't know. Hmm. A candle? I can't think. I've got to think of something.
Dark glasses?
No. I think people should see my eyes.
So do you feel...
But that's not a bad idea. Dark glasses is a possibility. But, you know, I think that's been kind of covered by Yoko.
God bless
her.
Do you feel like your speaking or singing voice is changing at all? Or that you're breathing better when you sing?
Well, I've not yet, no. But I think that will come.
Marianne Faithfull, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. It was a pleasure.
Marianne Faithfull's new CD is called Before the Poison. Here's another song from it, Crazy Love. The music is by Nick Cave, the lyric by Marianne Faithfull.
Hated by all and everywhere he goes, blazing contempt for human life and lies. Murderous heart and what he knows from life and fear in other people's eyes. Crazy love is all around me. Love is crazy, love is kind. But I know somehow you'll find me. Love is crazy, love is blind. She walks the boulevard without a care, knowing too much, but having come so far. Pretending life is just a game you play for nothing, loving no one and nowhere. Crazy love is all around me. Love goes crazy given time. But I know somehow you'll find me. Love is crazy, love is blind.
Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a collection of stories in the Lost Classics series. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
In her nearly 50-year career as a mystery writer, Margaret Miller pioneered the subgenre of psychological suspense. Her best-selling novels were hailed by Agatha Christie and Raymond Chandler. But Miller's restlessness as a writer may have been her undoing. She abandoned two popular detective series in favor of newer forms, fresher challenges. Most of her books are out of print, but a new volume of Miller's pulp stories called The Couple Next Door has just been published. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Call it the case of the lady who's all but vanished. It begins in a small town in Canada in the 1930s. High school classmates from opposite ends of the track meet up again after graduation. His name is Kenneth Miller, hers Margaret Sturm. They fall in love and marry. He begins teaching high school, she has a baby, and is misdiagnosed with a heart ailment, which confines her to bed. To keep from going stir-crazy, she writes a novel, a mystery called The Invisible Worm, that's published in 1941 and introduces one of the first psychoanalyst detectives into the genre. Margaret Miller starts churning out more mystery novels, which attract the notice of such fans as Agatha Christie, W.H. Auden, and Truman Capote. Her books are hailed by discriminating mystery reviewers as humdingers and real socceroos. She'll ultimately be named a Grand Master of the Mystery Writers of America and credited with fashioning the psychological suspense school of mystery fiction, later perfected by Ruth Rendell and Minette Walters. But I'm getting ahead of the case here. During World War II, Kenneth Miller serves in the Navy, while Margaret works at Warner Brothers on a screenplay of one of her novels. Inspired by his wife's success, Kenneth also begins writing mysteries. It takes his work some time to catch on. For the first 20 years or so of their life together, Margaret's literary career far outdistances her husband's. Then the wheel of fortune turns. Kenneth, under his pen name Ross MacDonald, is eventually lauded, along with Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, as one of the holy trinity of traditional hard-boiled mystery writers. Margaret's reputation begins to slip-slide into its long goodbye. She dies in 1994, and these days, all but a few of her novels are out of print. That's where the Lost Classics series enters into the picture. This small press operation is dedicated to rescuing stories from the crumbling pages of the pulp and slick magazines where they were first published. Lost Classics has just brought out a Margaret Miller volume called The Couple Next Door. It contains two near-novella-length stories and four short tales by Miller, and it's edited and introduced by Tom Nolan, author of a widely praised 1999 biography of Ross MacDonald. Nolan aims to trace Miller's development from a writer of comic mysteries to something else, a chronicler of the weird in human nature. His critical reasoning is sound, but unfortunately it means that the kickoff tale here is, to my mind, the weakest. Mind Over Murder, written around 1941, is a stiff-jointed curtsy to Agatha Christie's quarantined island thriller, And Then There Were None. It features Miller's popular series shrink detective, Dr. Paul Pyre, and a cast of zany neurotics, including the requisite nymphomaniac who tells Dr. Pyre that she thinks her trouble is that she's swarming with hormones. All are delivered to a colony for mental hygiene on a remote island in Lake Huron, where the murder victims begin piling up higher than the whodunit clichés. The stories that better serve Miller in this collection are the ones where her gothic sensibility seeps through, those where characters are undone by Promethean ambitions whose consequences they can't control. In McGowney's Miracle, for instance, a foolhardy funeral parlor director believes he's found the key to cheating death. But the story here with the strangest aura is a 1961 tale called The People Across the Canyon. It features a lonely 8-year-old girl named Kathy, whose parents cherish their privacy and their TV shows more than they do her. One evening, Kathy's mother notices the blue light of a TV screen shining from a previously empty house across the canyon. And Kathy, much to her mother's consternation, begins to make friends with the elusive young couple who've moved in. Like Jack Finney's classic story, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, The People Across the Canyon is a creeper, whose power derives both from the reality with which it imbues the supernatural, as well as from the way it uses the conventions of the supernatural to talk about everyday horrors, like the loss of loved ones to age, to changing loyalties, and to death. Margaret Miller lost her husband, Ross MacDonald, to the ravages of Alzheimer's in 1983. Until his death, as Nolan demonstrates through letters and anecdotes, the two were a relatively rare phenomenon, a successful literary couple who were each other's biggest fans. It's somehow appropriate that through this collection, Ross MacDonald's latest biographer is the one who's giving Margaret Miller her boost back into the spotlight.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Couple Next Door, a collection of stories by Margaret Miller. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Lauren Krenzel. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes, and from the Ford Foundation, whose magazine reports on how arts education is being used to boost student achievement in Texas schools at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen to recordings of bird songs with one of the world's leading experts on birdsong, Donald Kruidsma. Many of us would like to learn about the lives our parents lived before we were born. We'll talk with Sam Friedman, who followed through on that impulse for his new book about his mother. Join us for the next Fresh Air.